Well, good morning. For a congregation I've never been to, there are a lot of familiar faces here. And I appreciate that. It's always good to know people where you're going. And it's also good to meet new people. And I appreciate the opportunity that I have to be with you this week. And I hope it will be a profitable week. When I talk about lessons that are drawn from something that I've written, I'm always a little bit hesitant about mentioning it myself, because I don't want this to turn into a sales pitch, you know, put the QR code up on the screen where you can order a copy or anything like that. But also, I hesitate to not say anything, because in this case in particular, I know there are people here who have seen it, and it makes me think, well, what can I say that I haven't already written down that's going to be new and different? And maybe new and different isn't necessarily what people want. So we will be looking at several prayers. I found in my own studies that a way of, and in my own experiences, that a way of studying prayer that is not very frequently done is to look at prayers themselves in the Bible and study those. And I don't know if that's a universal experience or if that just was my little corner of the world, but in my experience, when people talk about prayer, we go look at Philippians 4 and 1 Thessalonians 5 and verses about concepts regarding prayer. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of study, for sure, but I'd never gone through kind of a systematic study of a variety of biblical prayers to see how faithful people in the past had prayed. And that's kind of what stood behind my own study on this and the classes that I've taught on it and, at this point, various gospel meetings that I've preached about it. And so that's where I'm coming from, just so you have a little bit of background in that, is studying these prayers in the Bible themselves. And what we'll do is we will approach them kind of in a three-step process, because I guess I'm a preacher and it's hardwired into us to do the three-point thing. But it tends to work pretty well with these, and that is to think about the context of the prayer, because it's helpful to know why the person is praying, what they're praying. Then we'll talk about the contents of the prayer, which is what does the prayer itself say. And in some of these, we'll look more detailed at the words. Some of these, we'll talk more big picture concepts. It varies from prayer to prayer. But then we'll talk about what I call connections, because I'm a preacher, they all have to start with the same letter. So the connections that we can make from these prayers to our lives and very practical sorts of things. So that's what we'll be doing with a series of different prayers. We'll be in Genesis chapter 32 this morning here in just a moment. The scripture reading was drawn from Genesis 32, some of the verses leading up to this, to help give us some of the context of this prayer and save me a little bit of reading time that way. Well, again, thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you. I appreciate the trust that the elders have in me to come and speak to you about these things. I do want to just say one more thing about myself personally, just because I know that this is going to be a question I'm asked a million times if I don't answer it to everybody all at once. So, yes, I have a wife and kids, and they are home. I wish I could have brought them with me, but it didn't work out on this trip. I have two sons. Their names are Silas and Judah, and they are 15 and 12 years old. So whenever I'm having dinner with you or chatting with you in the foyer or whatever the case is, that'll save us at least that question this week. In Genesis chapter 32, to talk about some of the context, again, we had some of this read for us. Jacob is about to meet Esau. And it's going to be the first time he's seen Esau in a couple of decades at this point, and things have changed pretty drastically since he was with Esau last time. You might remember that what happened the last time he was with Esau is he appropriated the blessing. A lot of people say he stole the blessing, and that drives me crazy because God earmarked the blessing to Jacob before he was born. It's really hard to steal what you own. You take possession of what you own, and he did so in a really nasty way. He lied to his father directly. The whole thing was all this subterfuge. His mom was involved. It was highly problematic. I'm not trying to justify what Jacob did, but the blessing was his. God said so. So I don't like the language of God, of Jacob stole the blessing. And I don't terribly like the language of he stole the birthright either, because what the text says is this is how Esau despised his birthright, not this is how Jacob stole his birthright. But it was highway robbery what he paid for it, I will admit that. But whatever the case may be, he and Esau have just a touch of a strained relationship. And what I mean when I say they have just a touch of a strained relationship is the last thing Esau said that Jacob was aware of is, as soon as Dad is dead, I'm going to kill him. And so he fled, and he went to stay with Laban, who was as nasty to Jacob as Jacob had been to everyone else. He kind of met his match. But throughout this entire process, Jacob has been a person who goes about things his own way. The fact that Rebekah suggests, and Jacob goes along with the idea of, it's not good enough to trust that God is going to manage this, let's lie about it to appropriate this blessing, to take possession of it, tells you he's a guy that wants to do things on his own. I mean, there's this non-biblical proverb that floats around from time to time, God helps those who help themselves. High on the list of things that drive me crazy. But be that as it may, Jacob was the sort of person who said, I'm not sure God's going to help me, so I'm going to help myself. That's more of his perspective. He just did things his own way all the time. That's who he's been. And he does that with Laban. Now, to his credit, by the end, what he's saying to his wives as he's about to leave is, God has blessed me. God has enlarged my flock. Your father tried to trick me, but God protected me. And so he has very consistently here at the end put his emphasis on God. But he tried to go about things on his own. And he leaves Laban behind in not much of a better state than he left Esau behind. I mean, Laban doesn't say, I will kill you, but what he does say is, if your God hadn't said otherwise, it is in my power to do you harm. So on one side of him is Laban, who is not happy with him. To say that he burned his bridges behind him is a bit of an understatement. He spit in the ashes, probably. In front of him is Esau, who last he knew wanted to kill him. And throughout his entire life to this point, he's been a person who just wants to go about things all on his own, to take charge, to take control, to do everything that he possibly can. He gets word here in Genesis chapter 32 that Esau is coming to meet him. And he is terrified. And he divides his camps up with the hope that if Esau attacks one, the other might survive. He prays to God in the text that was read earlier. And he sends a gift ahead to try to appease Esau when they meet. And after all of this, we get down to verse 22. And that same night, he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. Then he took and sent them across the stream, and everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Let me stop there for a second. We'll come back to this. It is an interesting thing that happens here. And what is just as interesting is what people have done with this over the centuries. I mean, you've probably heard this as Jacob wrestles with God or Jacob wrestles with an angel, and both of those are weird. This is one of those things that I think if you've grown up in the church or if you've been a Christian for a long enough period of time, it's very easy to take biblical stories for granted. To read them and be so familiar with them that we believe that it actually happened. We believe that it actually happened so much that we don't realize anymore just how strange it is. Someone shows up and wrestles with Jacob that is some sort of spiritual being. Now, I don't know about you. That is outside of my personal realm of experience. I've not had something like that happen. And all of the people that I know well enough to speak for them, it's not happened to them either. This is not normal. And so interpreters have tried to figure out what to do with this. And a lot of people have tried to read it allegorically. You know, maybe it didn't actually happen the way that it's written. That's the sort of thing that people say about the Bible a lot. A spiritual conflict of some kind. Or an allegory for a prayer I do believe there is prayer that happens here. He speaks to this person. He makes a request of this person. But what I would suggest to you is that what is the most important part of this scene is not figuring out the logistics of the fight. And that's a mistake that is very easy to make when we read the Bible. We get hung up on some detail that we really want to explain. We want to better understand it. We want to quantify it somehow. That's such an American sort of thing, right? To systematize and quantify. And be able to explain the logistics. That's what we want. Very scientific method sort of thinking. And so we get so hung up on what is happening in this fight that we don't realize that what is far more important than the fight is the conversation that follows it. And I've decided that I can live the rest of my life without ever completely understanding this fight if I can understand the conversation that follows it. Because that's what's really important in this scene. But there are a couple of things about the fight itself that we do need to mention, and so I do want to say something about that. And so the immediate context of this prayer is the fight. The background of his struggle with Jacob and his self-sufficiency and all that are important, but the immediate context is the fight. And so the first question is, with whom is Jacob fighting? Because in the text itself, what we just saw is a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. And that does not give us a whole lot of information. A man. Okay. So who is this man? Well, it is worth noting that when you get down to verse 30, and we're not that far in our reading yet, but we'll jump ahead for a second. Verse 30, Jacob calls the name of the place Peniel, saying, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." So Jacob very clearly understands this as an encounter with God. And that's not outside the context of the book of Genesis, because you might remember back in Genesis chapter 18 and 19, there are three men who appear to Abraham. And as that day unfolds, two of them continue on, one remains behind, and all of a sudden, at that moment, you realize that Abraham is talking to God. The three men who appear in Genesis 18, it sure seems like, is God and two angels in some sort of human form where they can be seen without Abraham dying or immediately recognizing who they are. And so the idea that God can appear in human form to suit his purposes certainly are not outside the realm of what God can do. We see that in Genesis 18. That seems to be the case here as well. However, when you get to Hosea, this scene is referred to again, and that maybe confuses the issue a little bit. In Hosea chapter 12 and verse 4, speaking of Jacob, it says, "He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor." And so, if you ever wondered, well, why do we say he wrestled with an angel when Jacob says it's God? It's Hosea. It's his fault. Blame Hosea, right? Hosea says he wrestled with an angel. Now, it's also worth noting that what it says right after that in the same verse is he met God at Bethel, and there God spoke with us. Yahweh, the Lord, in capital letters, the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial name. And so in that same context, in parallel lines with the word angel, is clear reference to God. And there is a figure in the Old Testament, the angel of the Lord, or the angel of Yahweh, who appears regularly in the Old Testament, and he is someone who bears the name of God and the authority of God and represents God, or is a representation of God, is probably a better way of putting it. And so in that parallelism of Hosea 12, angel and God in parallel lines suggests that it's probably to be understood as the angel of the Lord or God himself. So it seems, I think, pretty clear that God has taken human form to attack Jacob. And that's what it is. It's an attack. Jacob has stayed behind. He's resting for the night. He's preparing for the next day. And he gets attacked. And he is fighting with this person who he does not know the identity of. But the second question that must arise out of this is, if this is indeed some physical manifestation of God, how on earth can Jacob fight with him so well? He fights all night long and basically gets to the point of a draw. I mean, Jacob's a pretty tough guy. We have a misconception sometimes that he's something of a mama's boy, but he's a pretty tough guy. How tough do you have to be to fight with God and not lose in the first 5 seconds? Well, the answer is obvious, right? God is allowing this to suit his purpose. And God allows this because it sets the stage for the conversation that follows. And again, that's the most important part of this whole thing, is the conversation. Surely Jacob could not have competitively fought with God unless God permitted it to happen. But that does bring us ultimately to where the conversation is going. And the question, the third question before we get to the text itself is, who won the fight? Well, I'm not asking that because that's a American curiosity thing, you know. You find out two people are fighting. Maybe you're a fan of boxing or wrestling, whether it's real or fake or whatever it might be. You hear two people are sparring. You want to know who won, right? That's not why I'm asking that here. I'm asking that here because the text itself raises the question. Verse 25 says, "When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket. Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him." So this person is fighting with Jacob all night long, and he's not winning. And he sees that he's not winning. And then you get jump down a little bit further in verse 28. This man says to him, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." You have fought with God and man and have won. The text says Jacob won. The man could not prevail against him. The man admits, "You have striven with God and man and have prevailed." Now, on the other hand, it's really hard to think that Jacob won this fight. And not just because he's fighting against God. You look at the text itself. At best, he fought to a draw. Neither one was winning. His hip is the one that gets knocked out of socket. He's the one who's limping away. And we'll say a few more things about that in a second. It sure looks like he's the one who's losing this, if anything. And so in what way does Jacob win becomes the better question than who won. Jacob won, the text kind of says so. But how did he win when he didn't win? And we'll think about that as we look at this text. Picking up in verse 26, "Then he said, 'Let me go, for the day has broken.' But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' And he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' Then he said, 'You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.' And Jacob said, 'Please tell me your name.' But he said, 'Why is it that you ask my name?' And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, 'For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered.'" So Jacob has fought to a draw, and he has been injured and incapacitated from furthering the fight anymore. And he grabs the hole as tight as he can, and he refuses to let go. He's urged to let go, and he still stubbornly clings to his assailant, demanding a blessing from him. Jacob is at a point where he begins to fight with words instead of with strength at this point. And again, this conversation is the most important part of this entire scene. But notice that this is something else that shows the inferiority of Jacob. Yes, Jacob is the injured one, but that's not all. He's the one who is clinging and begging for a blessing. The greater blesses the lesser. That's part of the argument of the author of Hebrews regarding Jesus and Melchizedek, that priesthood versus the Levitical and Aaronic priesthood. Jacob is the one who gives up his name. Jacob is the one who has his name changed. Jacob is the one who is told no when he asks for the name of the person with whom he fights. Jacob is undeniably inferior. Jacob is undeniably losing in some sense, and yet God says Jacob has prevailed. How does Jacob prevail? And I really wish the text gave me a nice, buttoned-up, clean answer to that question. And I'm not entirely sure that what I've come to as a potential conclusion is the answer. But I think it's worth giving thought to. You see, what happens in this scene is Jacob has been striving to do everything his own way. Jacob has been a person of self-sufficiency his entire life. And when God shows up to fight with him, he fights with God. And now, he stops. He stops fighting against God, and he starts talking to God. He stops struggling against God, and he begins blessing God. How do you prevail against God? Well, you can't in one sense. That's the answer. You can never prevail against God in the sense that you are going to overcome Him in some sort of way. But I'll tell you what you can do. You can make it so that God does not prevail against you, and that's what Jacob does here. How do you make it so God doesn't defeat you? Well, the answer is really simple. Stop fighting against Him and start fighting with Him. Stop fighting against Him and start begging Him to be in your life. God will prevail against the person who refuses to submit to His will. But as we more closely and perfectly submit to His will, He will no longer prevail over us. You see, we win by losing. We win by giving up. We win by letting go of self and clinging to God instead. Isn't this the very lesson that Paul has to learn in 2 Corinthians chapter 12? It's not my strength. It's when I let go of my strength and I find my strength in Christ instead, that's when I am strong. When I stop relying on me and I start relying on God, that's where real strength comes from. That's where real victory comes from. And God no longer prevails against the one who is on His side. I think this same sort of idea stands behind Jacob giving up his name and receiving a new name. It's a change in his life. It's a different perspective from what he had before. This, and a name is a different thing in the ancient world. Yes, it's what you were called, but it was more than merely a designation. Your name was connected to your character in a lot of ways in the ancient world. And so Jacob, the heel grabber, Jacob, the deceiver, is becoming someone different instead here in this moment. He left Canaan full of self-sufficiency, crafty enough to make his own way, and through 20 long years, he has slowly changed to be a different person. Finally, he's saying to his wives at the end of his time in Paddan Aram, "Your father tried to trick me, but God was on my side." But here at this moment, Jacob must be completely done away with. And Israel, the one who has striven with God and prevailed, he is the one who must come back to Canaan. And that's what this is all about. And you see that also as the story continues to unfold here. Back in verse 30, Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." And then notice verse 31, it says, "The sun rose on him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip." That's one of those really fascinating verses. That it's easy to just read right past it. And I don't want to make too much of it because, again, the text is just there. It doesn't give us a lot of explanation. But I don't want to miss it either. What you have here in verse 31 is either a random time reference that shows up for no real reason whatsoever, except maybe it's interesting to know that it was the next day. Or you have one of these verses that means more than it says. I mean, if we were talking about the life of any person in this auditorium, and we were talking about a significant change that happened in that person's life, and I were to say, for this person, a new day dawned, what would I mean? Well, it just so happened the sun came up at that moment. Well, maybe if that's what's happening at the same time. But as literally a new day dawns for Jacob, at that same moment, metaphorically, a new day is dawning for Jacob. And what's really interesting is that this is the second time the sun is mentioned in the Jacob narrative. It shows up back in chapter 28 when he's leaving the promised land. And when he's leaving the promised land, we're told the sun sets as he goes to sleep that night at Bethel. And that's when he has that first dream. And so the sun sets when he leaves the promised land. And here as he's returning to the promised land, as Israel instead of Jacob, the sun rises again. Now, can I prove that that is literary artistry and designed to show us that his time away from the promised land is a period of darkness in some sense, and this is a new day dawning? I can't prove that. The text never says it, but it sure looks that way to me. That this verse is here to emphasize that very point. Leaving the promised land was a bad idea. Yeah, he thought he needed to do it to survive, but I'm pretty sure God could have handled the matter. Leaving the promised land was a bad idea. Abraham left and bad things happened. You know, Isaac was told, don't leave. And eventually Jacob's going to get the hint and he's not going to go to Egypt until God tells him he can. Leaving the promised land was a bad idea. But now as he's coming back to fulfill his vow at Bethel, he is coming back as a new person. And the last thing that I'll say about this conversation itself, before we try to draw some practical things out of this text, is I think this is not just a moment to change Jacob's path forward, but it's also an answer to his prayer. The prayer that shows up earlier as he is pleading with God about his meeting with Esau, the prayer that was read during the scripture reading back in verses 9 through 12. In verse 11 of this prayer in particular, what he says is, please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. Please deliver me from the hand of Esau. And notice what he says in verse 30, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. Now, I do think in context, he's talking about the fact that God didn't kill me like he could have. But at the same time, here God has blessed Jacob. Here God has set Jacob on a new direction, a new path for his life. That's what this is all about. And if God has delivered Jacob from God's very own presence, he can be completely certain that he can deliver Jacob from Esau as well. If he can wrestle with God all night long and walk away limp away a blessed man, Esau is not a problem. And his trust in God is moving in a new direction. Now, Jacob's not a perfect person, as no one is, but he begins a new life in a new way. Well, let me suggest to you just a couple of things about this that I think are practical and helpful for us as Christians today. My first thought has to do with the fact that Jacob clings to God for a blessing. He grabs a hold of God as tightly as he can, and he will not let go until he's blessed. That's what we need to do. Cling to God for blessing. even someone like Jacob, who struggled so mightily against God, to go his own way, do his own thing, be his own man. In a moment, he turned to rely upon God instead. And I tell you, that sort of thing is not easy to do, to change at all, much less to change that drastically and that quickly. And the only way that it happens is when one humbles himself, gives in to God, and confesses. You see, Jacob kept fighting as long as he thought he could win. And we will do the exact same thing. As long as we think we can do it on our own, as long as we think we can prevail, as long as we think we don't need God, even if we would never come out and say those words, as long as we think we can prevail, we will keep fighting. For Jacob, it was the crippling touch, and his efforts were turned in a new direction. It was the same persistence, but it was a persistence that held on for a blessing instead of a persistence that tried to win the fight. Finally, Jacob, crippled in his natural strength, became bold in the faith. And as a result, he was blessed by God. He was given a new name, a new character, and finds a new life as this new day dawns. And the same thing can be true for anyone in this room. When we stop fighting against God and start clinging to Him for a blessing, things change. Sometimes we think of the struggle of prayer in terms of Jesus' parable, the persistent widow. You know, if we pray enough, persistently enough, long enough, get enough people involved, eventually we can badger God into giving us what we want, so, you know, He'll get us off His back or whatever. And again, we would never come out and say it like that, but that sometimes seems to be kind of the background, subconscious maybe, of our thinking about things. Well, obviously that's hardly the point of Jesus' story, but it misses the bigger struggle of prayer. The struggle with prayer is not convincing God to give us what we want. The real struggle of prayer is the battle with self. It's learning to stop trying to convince God to give us what we want, and learn to submit to what God wants for us. To trust that He will do what is best, whether we believe it or not. Would you believe me if I told you that the thing that you hear sometimes about prayer, sometimes God says yes, sometimes God says no, sometimes God says wait, that doesn't have to be the case. It is entirely possible for you to pray in such a way that God always says yes every time. And it is when you sincerely tell God, this is what I want, but I know that you know better than I do. And if I am wrong, then don't give it to me and give me what you know is best. When we sincerely submit our will to God's in prayer, every prayer is answered in the affirmative. When we stop fighting against God and start submitting to God, things change. But it doesn't happen until we grab a hold and cling for a blessing. And the second thing that I'll say, the final thought that I'll have about this prayer, is it depicts very well the struggle of faith. And I would suggest to you that any depiction of the Christian life that doesn't deal with the reality of a struggle of faith is peddling a false Christianity. There are struggles that we have with temptations. There are struggles that we have from trials. There are struggles that we have from the circumstances of life. There are struggles that we have with getting out of our own way. And I don't think there's ever been a believer in the history of time who has not struggled with God somehow. Wrestled with Him in our own way. The faithful through the ages have struggled with God. Here Jacob does in a more literal sense than anyone else. Abraham struggles with God in prayer. Job struggles mightily with God, as does Jeremiah. Multiple psalmists in their laments struggle with God. We have an entire book in the Bible called the Book of Lament, or Lamentations is what we more commonly call it. Even Jesus learned obedience through what he suffered. And we see him in Gethsemane struggling between his desire not to go to the cross and his desire to do God's will. The struggle of faith is a real thing. And we need to not pretend like it isn't. We'll talk more about that specifically tonight. But what I'd say for now is that although many Christians are very quick to reject the health and wealth gospel for the fraud that it definitely is, we are tempted to replace it with an equally false happiness and perfect trust gospel, where we pretend our lives are flowing smoothly in every way. We don't like to talk about our struggles. We don't like to talk about our sins. We don't like to talk about our doubts. And we would rather pretend that our faith was perfectly fine in every way, even if it is teetering on the brink of collapse. Here is a prayer that reminds us that faithful people struggle. And that's okay, as long as we don't give up. Faithful people struggle, and that's okay, as long as we keep clinging to God. It's okay to have questions. You will always have questions because you will never have all of the answers. And that's okay. Just keep holding on to God. Well, Jacob running from his brother, Jacob running from Laban, reminds me of a story I heard a long time ago at this point in my life, but I always think of it when I think of this sort of running for your life thing. This story derives from older times out, kind of in the prairie areas, that part of America, where you will just have flat field that will go on as far as the eyes can see. There'll be drought periods of time where all of the grass just turns into, well, a fire waiting to happen. And on those big open plains, with no hills and no trees and nothing at all to stop it, a fire would sometimes start and a wind would get behind it that would move so fast across those prairies that it would be impossible to get away from it. If you got on the fastest horse you had and rode as fast as it could go in any direction at all, it would not matter. The fire would overtake you and you would die in it. You think, well, what did they do? Did they all just die when that happened? Actually, no, they didn't. They found a way to defeat those fires. They would start another one. Maybe that's where fight fire with fire came from. I don't know. But what they would do is they'd take a log from their campfire, and they'd move a little bit away from the fire that was coming, and they'd drop it on the ground in front of them, and the wind would take that fire off as well. And they would step out onto that place of scorched earth where the fire had already burned. And as their new fire continued to go, they kept moving into this big open spot of scorched earth. And you know what happened when the fire behind them caught up? There was nothing left there to burn. And it would safely move around them, and they would be okay. Paul tells us the wrath of God will be poured out against all ungodliness. You want to talk about a fire you can't run from? A fire you can't escape? No matter how fast you are, no matter how clever you are, no matter how good you think you've been, to put it in moral terms, we cannot outrun the fire of God. There is no escape. It will overcome us. It will overwhelm us. And if the fire is all of the story that there is, that's the end of the story. But there is a place of scorched earth there is a place of safety. There is a place where God's wrath has already been poured out in full force, that if we just step onto the scorched ground, when His wrath comes, we will find security there. And that place is at the foot of the cross of Jesus, who took our stripes, who bore our iniquities, who was wounded so that we can be healed. And that's the question that faces us today. Whether you're a Christian or whether you're not a Christian, the question is, am I standing at the foot of the cross? Because if your hope, your trust, your life is anywhere else, the fire will overtake you. Are you clinging to Jesus Christ for a blessing, trusting in the salvation that He brings from the wrath of God? Because there is no hope anywhere else. That's the question. If we can help you somehow today find your way to the cross, please let that be known as together we stand and sing.